Welcome to Signs of Life, exploring survival of consciousness, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation on the web at www.foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
I can feel you like an ocean that won't seem to let me go.
Good evening and welcome to Signs of Life, brought to you by Forever Family Foundation. With our host, Bob Ginsberg, I'm Fran Ginsberg, and our show tonight is sponsored by the Winbridge Institute for Applied Research and Human Potential. They can be found at www.winbridge.org. Our guest tonight is Dr. Dean Radin, and if you have a question, comment, or would like to talk to our guest, the toll-free number here is 888-627-6008. And how did your day go today, Bob?
Better than yesterday. So.
I agree.
It wasn't such a great day, but today was better. And I look forward to our guest tonight. It's always wonderful to talk to Dr. Radin, so we'll be bringing him up right after the first break. You know, we got an email yesterday from our good friend at Comlock Center, Kim Saavedra, and I'm glad she pointed it out to my attention because I really didn't know this, but are you familiar with the Family Medical Leave Act? I heard of it.
I've heard it quoted in a lot of different arguments and postings and petitions to sign and stuff like that, but I don't know it in its whole.
Yeah, evidently the federal government has developed this Leave Act, and it relates to circumstances when an employer must give somebody paid leave, and there are usually extraordinary circumstances like the birth and care of a newborn child or an immediate family member having a serious health condition, you know, significant life changes that require, you know, attention. And the point of this campaign was, oddly enough, there's nothing in there about grieving the loss of a loved one, you know. So, I mean, what is a situation if you had a parent that lost a child or even a spouse or losing a parent? There's no allowance, like these other categories, for, you know, any amount of time in paid leave. And that's a little disturbing. I would think that perhaps that's the most important, you know, thing. I mean, people, their world is upside down. And certainly they need some time to reflect and breathe.
That's very true. I mean, we hear about it time and time again, where particularly in the loss of a child, the parents become so devastated that they can't return to work. They can't leave the house. They can't function. They can't perceive another day coming before them where they have to get up and deal with it. So extending something like that would be fabulous, where they would have the opportunity then to seek some support and some help during that downtime where they're not worrying that they have to go to work.
Right, and they're certainly an employer would not have a very productive employee if they were forced to return under those circumstances. So it's one of those things that makes sense.
But I think for small businesses, all this stuff makes sense anyway. I think in smaller businesses, employers are more in touch with reality, and there's not this hierarchy of managers in between the basic workers and the big people running the organization and making the decisions. So in a small business, I think this stuff probably is well considered and covered. You know, if you have a funeral, even if it's, you know, a friend or an extended family member that you weren't, by all means, take off and go to the funeral. That's basically what goes on in a small business. But you know, the flip side of that, where you're personally grieving and you're having difficulty functioning, it's not something that's even been discussed. Although I would venture to guess in a small business, the entitlement would be there.
And it's something totally unrelated, as you pointed out to me on one of our power walks. You asked me a question, why is, when you're blowing on something, it comes out cool.
From your mouth.
From your mouth, right? But yet when you're breathing. Or,
when you yawn or when you are opening your mouth and forcing air out, it comes out warm. Like when you come in from the cold and your hands are cold, people have a tendency to open their mouths and to breathe heavily onto their hands to warm them up. So warm air is coming out of your mouth. Whereas if you're going to be served a hot bowl of soup, you purse your lips and you make a small opening and you blow, and now, miraculously, cold air comes out. Why is that? Coming from the same place.
And of course, when you told me that, I mean, so I had to test that hypothesis. So I started,
ordering soup?
No, I started blowing forcefully, you know, and to see, and it did feel cool, and then just, you know, opening my mouth, and like you said, like a yawn, and it was coming out warm. So I was amazed at that fun fact.
What's the explanation? What's the scientific explanation? Well, the scientific explanation is, they don't really know. They don't really know. In this report that I read, there were several scientists who gave explanations of what they guess it would be. One of the scientists did some informal testing himself and drew conclusions from that data, which we know from our immense amount of data on survival of consciousness, we are forbidden to draw conclusions. So I think that this is funny that here's mainstream science with something so simple as blowing on hot food to cool it off or warming your hands with your breath. They don't have an answer, but that's okay. That's okay they don't have an answer for that. But we're not allowed to look for an answer for survival of
Well, you know, when I saw you had that article, I was just wondering how you were going to tie that into survival of consciousness, and you managed to do it, Fran.
Because this is the stuff out there that shows us that mainstream science doesn't get it. They don't get it.
Well, and speaking of mainstream science, I see they were also honoring Nikola Tesla.
Yes, which I thought was a wonderful, wonderful thing. Of course, in honoring him, they always have to turn it around and not really bring up what he was all about. But
he was all about a lot of things.
He was all about a lot of things. And so much so that he had a lab where he conducted a lot of experiments on Long Island in New York. And it was left in disrepair for many, many years. And a small group of people got together and got it out there on the internet and raised funds and got some other organizations together, and they managed to save this thing, and they're going to turn it into a museum. So what they did was they had created a statue, a sculpture of Nikola Tesla to be erected on the site, and it had its unveiling this week. And the Serbian president, because Nikola Tesla is Serbian, came all the way from Serbia to do the unveiling of this statue. And it's quite interesting because they don't go too far into what he did from the perspective of the work we know that he did. But they do make claims of him inventing the major components that were used in radio and electricity. Unseen thing.
Far ahead of his time, and with his knowledge about unseen fields of energy, it's a shame he didn't live longer, because he might have been on the right track in discovering so many things.
Well, he probably was on the right track, but unfortunately died penniless because other people took credit for the work that he did. Right. In 1943 at the New Yorker Hotel in Manhattan, he was 87 years old.
We're going to go to our break, and when we come back, we're going to have the world-renowned scientist, Dr. Dean Radin. So stay with us, and we'll be back in a few.
Don't miss Forever Family Foundation's 7th Annual Conference Weekend, November 9th and 10th, this year in warm and sunny San Diego, California. In Search of the Afterlife, Experiencing, Communicating, Connecting to Another World, is designed for general audiences interested in learning about evidence of an afterlife. Attendees will be treated to cutting-edge presentations of evidence that we survive our physical deaths, as well as demonstrations of spirit communication by certified mediums. Add on the optional Friday night fundraiser dinner featuring medium Kim Russo, host of The Haunting of TV show, and stay an extra day for Media Monday. For more information, visit www.foreverfamilyfoundation.org or call 631-425-7707. That's 631-425-7707.
It is with great pleasure that we announce the formation of the Wimbridge Institute for Applied Research in Human Potential. Dr. Julie Beischel, Director of Research at Wimbridge and one of the premier investigators in the field of mediumship research, reports that the team at Wimbridge will continue pursuing the many unanswered questions that remain in the field of afterlife science. Please go to www.windbridge.org to learn more about this groundbreaking research institute. That's www.windbridge.org.
When grieving the loss of a loved one, sometimes a hug is just what you need. Hugs from Heaven are lightly weighted shoulder wraps that are made from the fabric of your loved one's clothing. Your clothing can also be made into memory pillows and sachets. Each Hugs from Heaven is handmade with loving care and is as unique as your loved one's spirit. Visit us at hugsfromheaven.com. That's hugs, spelled with a Z, from heaven.com. Who couldn't use a hug?
I would like to introduce you to the Forever Family Foundation, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to provide a forum where individuals and families who have suffered the loss of a loved one can turn for support, information, and hope. We believe in the continuity of the family, even though a member has left the physical world. The Forever Family Foundation is a joint effort of scientists, research mediums, and interested people who support the premise that life does not end with physical death. We wish to prove that the bond of the family cannot be broken even by death. We invite anyone who's trying to cope with the loss of a loved one to contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707. That's 631-425-7707. Or you can find us on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
Welcome back to Signs of Life, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation.
Our guest tonight is Dr. Dean Radin. Our sponsor is the Wimbridge Institute for Applied Research in Human Potential, and they can be found on the web at www.windbridge.org. Bob?
And it's our pleasure to welcome back Dean Radin, Ph.D. He's chief scientist at the Institute of Noetic Sciences. He's an adjunct faculty in the Department of Psychology at Sonoma State University. Before joining the research staff of IONS in 2001, Dean held appointments at AT&T Bell Labs, Princeton University, University of Edinburgh, SRI International, where he worked on a classified program that investigated psychic phenomena for the U.S. government. He's the author or co-author of over 200 technical and popular articles, a dozen book chapters, and three wonderful books, including the award-winning The Conscious Universe, also Entangled Mind, and most recently, Supernormal, Science, Yoga, and the Evidence for Extraordinary Psychic Abilities. Welcome, Dr. Radin.
Thank you so much. Please call me Dean.
Okay. Well, you know, Where to begin? I mean, you've probably amassed more irrefutable data about psi phenomena than perhaps any scientist alive. And I could remember when I first read The Conscious Universe, and that was at a time, I would add, that I was certainly on the fence about psi in general. And I remember reading the statistical evidence and the odds against chance and saying to myself, wow, you know, how can any credible scientist not acknowledge this data? It just speaks for itself. And yet, as the years go by, there are still many of your colleagues that ignore the data. They just refuse to acknowledge it. So, I mean, I know this to some degree must frustrate you. I mean, were there times when you questioned your chosen career path in your scientific exploration?
No, not at all. Okay. The fact that controversial topics are not accepted, even when there's empirical evidence, the history of science shows that this is to be expected. So, and I knew that. I mean, I knew just from reading about history that any new idea that challenges vested interests, whether they're economic or political or in this case ideological, that you face a strong uphill battle. And I knew that, and I wasn't afraid of it. And what has driven me primarily in this course of research is my own curiosity. So I want to know what's going on. And in the process, I'm doing some studies and publishing papers and giving talks and so on. And if it doesn't convince a certain percentage of the scientific community or the general population, I don't really care. I have the long view here, and I'm adding to evidence that in the long run, I think we'll make a radical change in what we think about ourselves and the universe. And if it doesn't happen overnight, that's okay.
Mm. Well, you've been, I think you realize that at some point we're all going to get it, and you're perfectly willing to wait that out. I mean, have you seen progress, though? I mean, for instance, the academic journals, I mean, are they still... do they still look upon evidence of psi as a threat, or do they embrace it a little bit more than they used to?
Some journals, and this has to do with what the editors believe, of course, some editors are very, very concerned about the image of the journal, and they're concerned that if they seem sympathetic to this topic, that their own credibility will be at stake. And so here, again, we have a vested interest in terms of one's social standing. But even with that, I would say that the number of articles that are being published now in mainstream journals is dramatically increased in even just the past 5 years. And so some of this is because the old prejudices are slowly dying away as we're presented with all kinds of new and interesting things in physics and in biology and other domains. A lot of the dogma that used to drive the social fabric of science is beginning to unravel, which is great. And so there's a new openness to entertaining this kind of research. And, of course, it's still this kind of research has to be done better than conventional research. It's held to a higher standard, and that sometimes is frustrating. But nevertheless, it's also understandable. So that's fine. That means that the research that is published usually tends to be exceptionally good.
Mm. I definitely agree with that. Now, in the new book, Supernormal, it's a bit of a departure from the other two books. I mean, of course, the scientific research plays a big part, but you dare to suggest that yogic superpowers can be explained by the research. So what initially got you interested in yoga? Is it something that you are interested in personally? I mean, do you practice yoga? I mean, it's not a topic that's typically discussed in scientific circles.
Well, yes, I've practiced yoga and meditation on and off for many years. I've been more disciplined about my meditation practice over the last couple of years. But the both yoga and meditation now are solidly mainstream in the West. It used to be that probably 20 to 30 years ago, if you wanted to find a yoga studio, you could find it in New York City and San Francisco, and that's it. Today, you can find many yoga studios in every city, almost every city in the entire United States and all throughout Europe and everywhere. I mean, it's very popular.
Right.
One of the reasons it's popular is because it works. From the point of view of the scientific tests on the use of yoga therapy for the treatment of chronic mental and physical problems, it's effective and it's cheap and it works. So that research has pushed it into the mainstream and people like it. The same is now happening for meditation. There are a number of very good studies on different kinds of meditation and showing that for certain, again, chronic problems having to do with anxiety and depression and so on, that it can be significantly helpful. And it's cheap, and so people are using it.
Yeah.
So I figured, okay, it took quite a while. It took probably 40 to 50 years for the West to begin to embrace the idea of yoga and meditation being good. And it's lost a lot of the esoteric, exotic flavor of the East, because what we practice as yoga and meditation is very Westernized. Nevertheless, it's there. It comes from this ancient tradition. So I figured there are probably 20 million people in the United States alone who are practicing yoga and meditation and don't actually know where it came from. They may see it as a quasi-spiritual form of aerobics, which is partially true, but it's much more than that. And so I thought about writing this book when I was invited a couple of years ago to give a series of lectures in India. And, of course, I knew something about India, but had never visited it before and didn't know the extent to which how the culture is really, really different. In Indian culture, what we would look at as a psychic or spiritual phenomena is completely accepted everywhere. Everyone, even scientists, accept it. There is, of course, justifiable skepticism also because a lot of the claims that go on are outrageous and probably wrong. But the basic idea that we have exceptional capacities inherent in us, that's very widespread. And so I went to India to talk about psychic phenomena, and I, of course, immediately cast it in terms of the yoga superpowers, which are called the siddhis. Siddhi is a Sanskrit term meaning attainment or perfection, and it's referring to what happens when you are disciplined in your meditation practice. Well, you attain certain abilities. Those are the superpowers. So what I found is, when I gave talks at both yoga universities and conventional universities, everyone is wildly interested in these topics. Even if they're Western-trained academics, they're still interested in it. So I was a little bit surprised to find that virtually no one in India, maybe one or two exceptions, but hardly anyone out of the over a billion people there, are doing scientific examination of these abilities, which are part of the culture. And then I suddenly realized, well, they would figure from their perspective, why do you need to do study on this stuff, given that we know that is true?
Right.
And so the irony is, here I am a Western scientist devoting my career to the study of these phenomena in a society that's very skeptical about it, and that's necessary. You see, within our society, within Western society, it's the very skepticism and incredulity about these abilities that push they push my curiosity. I think, how is this possible? If I were an Indian, I would probably be thinking, well, I should study something else because why bother studying something which is so obvious?
Yeah, well, it's an interesting point. I think that it's probably a mistake for many people in the West to attribute certain psi phenomena as a spiritual endeavor. I mean, some people can only explain it in spiritual terms, but yet it seems to be, as you point out, just something that's an inherent ability in all of us, the same as our other physical senses. So, I mean, I guess that's something, a total departure of what you found in India, right?
Right. It's also the case that when people talk about things that are non-physical or spiritual, they don't often have a very clear sense of what they mean by that. It kind of comes from an idea of a very strict dualism, that there is mind-like stuff and there is physical matter-like stuff, and the two are really different. Well, one of the things that science has learned over the years is that there's probably a spectrum here. And the spectrum is such that it's very difficult to tell where consciousness arises. And, of course, this leads a lot of philosophers to the idea that it doesn't actually arise out of anything. It's just there in the background all the time and everything, all the way down to atoms and all the way up to the universe. So this panpsychist view is similar to the Indian philosophies, not all of them, but some of the Indian philosophies, that's the core. Consciousness is as fundamental as energy and matter. And they coexist in an interesting way. And so when somebody in the West talks about spirituality, maybe we're talking about a form of substance that is kind of physical, except that we don't understand it very well yet. And this may even be true for consciousness. We can think of it as a kind of a strange substance that may or may not exist in space-time, but it has certain properties. And at some point in the future, maybe next Tuesday, maybe 100 years from next Tuesday, we'll be able to close the gap between our current solidly materialistic or physicalistic view of reality and close the gap with what we think of now as consciousness, spirituality, mysticism, and so on. Mm. At that point, we'll have a very nice merging. We'll have an integration of the ancient wisdom of the West or of the East and the modern wisdom of the West. And then we create something entirely new. That's what I look forward to.
Mm. And that point was probably not lost on you in India. You know, here you are with all your advanced training and decades of research, and it's sort of, as you described it, it's sort of like being brought down a peg, you know, because you don't have to tell us this stuff. I mean, we already know from the ancients what your research is showing today.
Right.
You know, and that's what part of the book Supernormal is about. I mean, you go into, when you talk about these the superpowers of the cities, what are some of these superpowers? I mean, things like bilocation, levitation, or?
Well, when you look at cities within religious and mystical traditions, there are actually hundreds that are listed. So what I've done in the book is I focus on Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, because this is a classical book of yoga, and more importantly, Patanjali spent one quarter of the book specifically on the cities, and he identifies about 25 of them. But if we do a taxonomy, you see that they actually only fall into three categories. And this is true even within Catholicism, for example, there are hundreds of cities that are mentioned, and Buddhism has hundreds. Well, the three categories are exceptional mind-body connection. A second category is clairvoyance, and the third category is mind-matter interactions or psychokinetic effects. So within the first category of exceptional mind-body connections, we're talking about unusual things having to do with the body itself, and meaning your body. So that can mean something like levitation. Now, levitation you might think of as mind over matter, and it kind of is, except that it's your body that something is happening to. So I put that in the class of exceptional mind-body. So levitation, the opposite of that is called gravitation, in which instead of becoming very light, you become extremely heavy. You can't be moved. There's inedia, which means not eating. So you basically meditate and draw the energetic nutrients into your body where they're transmuted into the form where your body can live perfectly well. There's exceptional healing capacity, not only things like rapid wound healing, but chronic illnesses. You think the right way and they go away, and so on. So there's that category. That's roughly a quarter of the cities fall into that category. Most of the cities, maybe 70%, are clairvoyance. And they're chopped up into different kinds of clairvoyance. from the very micro world to the very macro world, but they're all basically the same idea, that you can perceive beyond the ordinary senses. And then a small slice, maybe 10% of the cities, are direct mind-matter interactions, usually between you and something that's not your body, something outside your body at a distance. So those are the cities. As I mentioned, in Catholicism, these are known as the charisms. So somebody who has charisma is seen as having this special gift. The difference between Catholicism and yoga is that in Catholicism, the charisms are considered a divine gift. They're something given to you from the divine source, whereas in yoga, these are inherent capacities of humans that we can develop through disciplined practice.
And some of these, the various phenomena, we in the West would consider them to be miracles. And miracles usually fly in the face of science, do they not? I mean, people, a lot of your colleagues get very uncomfortable when you discuss miracles.
Now, the way I think of it is miracles fly in the face of science until we figure it out, and then it's not a miracle anymore.
Right.
then it's a technology. I mean, just think about taking an iPhone to somebody 100 years ago. It would be such a miracle that their head would explode.
Exactly.
I mean, yeah. So we're used to things now where we understand things well enough so we can make a technology, and most of it is incredibly miraculous. And we have a very highly refined way of manipulating the physical world. But we just barely scratched the surface. You know, when you look at the explosion of knowledge in science in general, it's still on a very fast upward curve. So it's very difficult to predict at this point what science and technology will bring in 50 years, say. It's almost impossible to imagine what that will be like. And another way to point out this is we're old enough, so we remember a time before there was any internet at all. And so
Absolutely.
In a very short space of time, an invention came along that has transformed the world in many ways. And so young kids today with smartphones cannot imagine a time when you couldn't call anybody basically almost for free and have a computer sitting in your palm. I mean, we're just at the beginning of a major change in the way we think of what's possible and what isn't. So I'm not bothered by miracles at all.
No, you just made me think, if you brought the internet into an organized religion several hundred years ago, they would explain that it was something produced by divine intervention, I would imagine, which is totally different from the views expressed by the yogic view, right? I mean, they don't think of these things as divine intervention. How do they view these things? They just simply the way it is. Is that a fair assessment?
It's the way it is. Yes, the yogic philosophy basically says that the universe consists of three principles. There's the principle of pure consciousness. It simply exists. It's everywhere. And it's not in space-time. It's outside of space-time. It's before space-time. The second part is matter, energy, space-time, like the world that science is used to looking at. And then the third aspect is the mind. And the mind is the bridge between pure consciousness and the world, everyday world. So what that means is that what the neurosciences are studying is the physical aspect of the mind. It's the matter, energy, space-time portion of the mind itself. But the mind is also consists of pure consciousness. And so the struggle that's going on in science now to define what consciousness is a little bit stuck because it's doing pretty well on the physical side, but it doesn't yet admit that there's something else going on. But nevertheless, that's the yogic view. And so within yoga, special abilities that arise that they would call siddhis and we would call psychic are simply a reflection of this pure consciousness, which is outside of space-time and can do things that wouldn't make any sense from the point of view of inside space-time.
We are talking with Dean Radin. He is the author of his latest book. It's called Supernormal, Science, Yoga, and the Evidence for Extraordinary Psychic Abilities. You can find out a lot more information on Dean's website, very hard website to remember, deanradin.com. And there are also links on the Forever Family Foundation website, Amazon links to purchase that book. We come back, we're going to be talking a lot more about Supernormal, so stay with us, and we'll be back in a few.
Don't miss Forever Family Foundation's 7th Annual Conference Weekend, November 9th and 10th, this year in warm and sunny San Diego, California. In Search of the Afterlife, Experiencing, Communicating, Connecting to Another World, is designed for general audiences interested in learning about evidence of an afterlife. Attendees will be treated to cutting-edge presentations of evidence that we survive our physical deaths, as well as demonstrations of spirit communication by certified mediums. Add on the optional Friday night fundraiser dinner featuring medium Kim Russo, host of The Haunting of TV show, and stay an extra day for Media Monday. For more information, visit www.foreverfamilyfoundation.org or call 631-425-7707. That's 631-425-7707.
It is with great pleasure that we announce the formation of the Wimbridge Institute for Applied Research in Human Potential. Dr. Julie Beischel, Director of Research at Wimbridge and one of the premier investigators in the field of mediumship research, reports that the team at Wimbridge will continue pursuing the many unanswered questions that remain in the field of afterlife science. Please go to www.windbridge.org to learn more about this groundbreaking research institute. That's www.windbridge.org.
Victor and Wendy Zammit, researchers of the afterlife for over 30 years, have released their new book, A Lawyer Presents the Evidence for the Afterlife, What Really Happens When We Die. It has received rave reviews and is a comprehensive look at all of the evidence, including physical mediumship, near-death experiences, deathbed visions, after-death contacts, reincarnation, and a host of other phenomena that will prove that we are much more than our physical bodies. To learn more or to sign up for their free newsletter, visit www.victorzammit.com. That's www.victorzammit.com.
For years, people have been reporting communication from those no longer in our physical world. Historically, science and religion have taught us to ignore such messages. Yet, there is now substantial scientific evidence to the contrary. In response to this, the Forever Family Foundation has developed a sign registry to demonstrate the existence of this other dimension. On our website, people can register signs that they, after passing, plan on communicating to a specific loved one. Upon the registrant's passing, the stored information can be verified by the recipient of these signs. Participants will be taking part not only in a grand scientific experiment, but in providing the greatest gift of all, the knowledge that we survive our physical death. For more information, contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707, or you could find us on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org. Or to register a sign, go directly to thesignregistry.com.
Welcome back to Signs of Life, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation.
Just tuning in, our guest tonight is Dr. Dean Radin. Our sponsor is the Wimbridge Institute for Applied Research in Human Potential, and they can be found on the internet at www.winbridge.org. If you're a business interested in advertising on our show, please contact us via email at radio@foreverfamilyfoundation.org or call the office at 631-425-7707. 1-800-273-8107. And now before we get back to our show, it's time for some foundation messages for our listeners. There are three ways to show us you like Signs of Life Radio. First, go to the Signs of Life Radio page on Facebook and like us. Two, use the donate button on any one of our weekly email show reminders to support programming. There's also a space to add a comment on what you love and what you don't like so much about the show. And three, remember us when you shop. Yes, when you shop, you can support the work of our 100% volunteer not-for-profit organization without spending any additional money at all. First, you will need a credit card to shop online. So if you don't already have one or are in need of another, go to foreverfamilyfoundation.org and apply for the Visa credit card. Visa will make a donation to us for each card that's taken out, and each time the card is used, a portion of that charge is donated back to Forever Family Foundation. Second, if your shopping takes you to the Internet, consider shopping at Amazon.com, but first use the link on the Forever Family Foundation website, and again, a portion of your spending comes back to support our work. Now, if you don't see what you want on Amazon, then sign up with iGive.com and name Forever Family Foundation as the charity of your choice. Then search iGive.com for your items. For each search, we receive a donation. And when you find what you are looking for in their more than 1,300 online stores, like the Apple Store, Big Dogs, Old Navy, Weight Watchers, a portion of what you spend is again donated back to Forever Family Foundation. So please take a few moments when you shop to show us that you care. Our 7th annual conference will be held this year in beautiful and warm San Diego, California at the DoubleTree by Hilton Golf Resort, November 9th and 10th. Mark the dates as this will be the best one ever. Make your plans now for the Friday night banquet featuring Kim Russo, star of the hit TV series The Haunting of, as she will be bringing through spirit communication from the other side following dinner. Then the conference begins early Saturday and early Saturday morning through Sunday evening, and we also have added on Medium Monday, so check our website for registration and information now. Our Holidays Past raffle is in full swing. You might want to get in while the number assignments are still low, as a computer program pulls the winners by assigned numbers. The mediums in this raffle are Dave Campbell, Eliza Ray, Nancy Marlowe, Tracy Lee Nash, and Catherine Nadal. It's only $5 a chance. And our annual December Holidays Past events are scheduled for Natick, Massachusetts with medium Suri Bernson on December 7th, Pompton Lakes, New Jersey with medium Janet Nohavik on December 14th, and on December 21st, it's Angelina Diana in South Windsor, Connecticut, and Amy Utzman in Fort Myers, Florida. Watch for the event pages on the Forever Family Foundation website and email notifications in your inbox. Back to you, Bob.
And we're back talking with Dr. Dean Radin, the author of Supernormal. Website is deanradin.com. Dean, in the introduction to your book, you mentioned something to the effect that escaping outward has become risky in modern times versus escaping inward. Can you elaborate a little bit on that? What do you mean by escaping inward?
Well, the idea here is that when people think that they're getting bored or frustrated with their life and they want to try something new, well, the usual way that we do that is we go on vacation and then it starts getting expensive. We want to escape out because that's the usual way of thinking about it. The escaping in is perhaps a different way of thinking about it that psychotherapists are used to, where if you're unsatisfied with your life or your job or something and you feel you need to just run away, well, what are you running from? In some cases, you're actually in a place where you literally need to get to a different place. So we're not talking about that. We're talking more about what amounts to a change of attitude or a change of the way you think about who and what you are. And so escaping inward is very popular now. Young people have done it probably throughout history, where you experiment with various mind-altering drugs and methods to perceive the world in a different way. Of course, a much safer way of doing this is meditation, and the goals are more or less the same. It's a way of diving deep inside, escaping from the everyday way of seeing reality. And one hopes that in the process that you learn that there, the everyday consciousness is a very thin slice of what is actually out there. And so that has a certain appeal to it as well.
So in effect, we're really only getting to see the big picture by looking within as opposed to what's surrounding us physically.
Well, you can, looking out does that too. Like the, one of the reasons why travel in other cultures is so useful is because by contrast, you can look back at your own life and see how provincial it is. You know, we spend a lot of time doing things and not thinking about it very much because we're used to it. But you go to another culture, lots of things seem extremely different, and that's why it's useful to travel. So by contrast, or maybe similarly then, traveling inside your mind can be just as much of an eye-opener, so to speak, as traveling to another country.
So, you know, you in the book, in Supernormal, you wrote something to the effect that, you know, questioning, well, why don't we all have, you know, these same supernormal powers as the cities? And you explained that it's our distracted minds and beliefs that act as filters. So, I mean, I've heard it said that our brains were designed to be a filter of information because if they didn't act as a filter, we'd be bombarded and then wouldn't be able to function in the physical world. Is that mm-hmm. something you agree with?
Yes. Yeah, if you just... one of the estimates I've heard recently of how much information is impinging on us at any given time versus how much we're actually consciously aware of. And the ratio is 1 trillion to 1. There's 1 trillion times more stuff that is impinging on us than we can sense or that we are consciously aware of. And you can kind of see how evolution would shape the brain and the human to only pay attention to a very limited amount of information that is mostly right here and right now. Because if you want this, you want the organism to persist, it can't be worrying about what's happening on Pluto next month. It has to worry about what's happening about 6 feet away from you right now. So, yes, I think the brain is essentially a information processing unit, but it has very heavy filters on it that at least within ordinary awareness, ordinary waking awareness, is focused here and now. And so if this were true, what I just said, then non-ordinary awareness, which includes meditation and drugs and dancing and dreaming and all the other states of awareness we can be in, maybe those should be more conducive to psychic awareness. And in fact, both anecdotally and experimentally, we know that that is true. So it does seem as though ordinary waking awareness is a very particular kind of awareness that many people believe is all there is, but in fact, it's a very thin slice of reality.
Mm. This is more of a philosophical question, but do you think that possibly that's our purpose here to recognize these other states of awareness and other realms of consciousness that are normally unseen to most people? I mean, including the possibility of survival. You know, I mean, maybe we were put here just to catch glimpses of these other realms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the question of purpose is a difficult one because science doesn't deal with purpose. It's a little bit like the question why. You know, well, why does the charge on the electron this particular amount? And there are some answers that have to go with well, the structure of the universe would be different if it was anything other than the way that it is, and that's not really very satisfying because it really doesn't address the fundamental why question. Why is anything? Why do we have the capacity to even ask these questions? So I don't have any response to that. I don't know how to respond to the questions of purpose.
No. Well, you certainly couldn't explain it from a scientific point of view. It's outside the realm of science. But let me ask you this. As I'm reading the book, I'm thinking to myself, all right, there are evidently still these extraordinary people that have these abilities, these cities where they can perform what we would consider, you know, feats of mystical occurrences or magic. So, and I'm saying, you know, well, why doesn't Dean get him into the lab? You know, we could certainly learn a lot, you know, by getting into their brains. And then I got to the section where you talked about that there's an inherent problem with that, you know, because the very nature of their thought process goes against exhibition, you know. So, I mean, mm-hmm. There's a certain paradox there. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Right. At least most of the traditions that involve development of these abilities have a very strong stricture in it to not demonstrate it. So within some yoga traditions, it's even stronger than that. It says that you will probably end up with feelings of clairvoyance and telepathy and so on, but don't pay any attention to it because it's a distraction from what your actual goal is. In that case, the goal is enlightenment. To realize to a much greater degree than we usually think about of who and what you are. You recognize yourself as being self with a little s is identical to the universe with a large s, or large u. You become the same as the universe. Well, that's a mystical state, and that's the goal, at least of some of the yogic paths. So if that's the goal, then if you start getting distracted by all these wonderful powers, it'll pull you off the goal. And in the worst case, we're dealing here with powers, and the word power is a useful word because power is seductive, and the seduction will lead to a fall. So in a mythological sense, when somebody gains a certain power of this type, you struggle with it because you could become Darth Vader or you could become a Jedi.
And as, right.
You know, that the story is it touches us, and we know something, some truth in that mythology, because we see it again and again in our stories. That great, as Spider-Man said, with great power comes great responsibility. And humans tend to be weak when we're presented with great power. And so this was recognized by the yogis, and that's why they have the restriction that says, If there's a yogi out there who can do all kinds of interesting things, and I want them to come to the lab, they know they can't do that.
Mm.
So who's left over? What's left over are ordinary people who occasionally have a psychic experience. It's not under their control, tend to be kind of weak, it's sporadic, but they can do enough so we can see things in the lab. And then you have a category of people who have become delusional. Not because their sense that they can do something psychic is false. It may well be real. But they become delusional with visions of grandeur, and they think they're the next Messiah, and their ego is very inflated by their abilities. And I don't want to deal with those people. So it becomes difficult then to find exactly the right person who is both psychologically well-grounded, who is not suffering from delusions, whose ego is not wrapped into their ability. And that becomes a very limited subset.
Mm. You know, when we talk about, we're very interested in the work that you do. When we talk about subjects, you know, of clairvoyance and precognition and telepathy and remote viewing and distant healing. Sometimes people ask, well, "Why are you interested in that?" Because what does that have to do with survival? And that survival is really the main focus of the foundation. But, I mean, my answer always is that I think it lays the groundwork. You know, if we could show that the mind can act independently of the brain and transcend time and space, then it makes the survival hypothesis plausible or even, in my mind, logical. So is that a wrong answer?
No, that's exactly the right answer.
Okay.
Because if you look at something like near-death experience, if it wasn't for description of distant locations that could be verified as being correct in a near-death experience, virtually all of the rest of it could be thought of as various forms of hallucinations and dreams. I mean, they might be very vivid dreams and unusual forms of hallucinations and all that, but you wouldn't need to challenge the prevailing opinions or prevailing assumptions within the neurosciences. It's precisely because people say, I'm out of my body, I'm seeing something, and it's real, and you could also then show that the person couldn't either infer that information or guess it, or it wasn't sensory cueing and all that. That does point in the direction that something about mind is not exactly the same as the brain. And the moment that that is seen as plausible, then the likelihood of any form of survival is much, much greater.
Mm. Okay. And once again, we have been enjoying a talk with Dr. Dean Radin. The website is deanradin.com, and that's Dean, D-E-A-N-R-A-D-I-N.com. The book, A Supernormal, Science, Yoga, and the Evidence for Extraordinary Psychic Abilities. I would encourage everybody to pick it up. It's a wonderful book, and there will be a book review coming out in the next Foundation newsletter. Dean, thanks so much for being with us. We really appreciate it. We hope to be able to talk to you again real soon.
It's my pleasure to talk. I'll be happy to come back.
Thank you, Dean. Have a good evening.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
We now ask our listeners to please join us in our Healing Energy Circle prayer. May the universe create a channel of healing energy from our participating listeners, sending that energy to those who are in need of the recovery of the physical body, spirit, and mind, as we visualize the healing light upon Francis Mastracco, Tim Donahue, Deb Martin, Tina Jocelyn, Barbara Russell, Vicki Steffi, Wendy Lippo, Mark Barron, Eileen Lafada, Rita Springer, David Hayes, Barbara Patillo, Glenna Irwin, Julie B., Stanley Mullen, John Borland, Flora Prisco, Miriam Pierschka, Tanya Cash, Andy O'Brien, Jeanette Davies, Janice Farelli, Joel Auerbach, Lenny Ficarelli, Rachel S., Lynn Cheney, Kimberly Saavedra, Johnny Jackson, Henry Stark, John Kahali, and Joan Lipke. Now let us, as one consciousness, give our energy of loving thought by praying like this: to love one another, to treat others as we would like to be treated, to forgive others and return love for hate, kindness for anger, to spread this feeling to everyone, to our fellow man, as well as the earth and its environment. And now it's time for us to say,
our loved ones are only a heartbeat away,
and science is going to prove it.
Good night, everyone.